Amid the nationwide cries of energy crisis and demands for price controls, are calls asserting the need for government to pave the way for even more intense fossil fuel extraction programs. For the last 18 years, there's been a moratorium in place precluding the federal licensing of new offshore oil and natural gas drilling platforms in ecologically critical areas of the United States coast. Areas included in this moratorium are the East and West Coasts, sections of Florida's coast, and Alaska's Bristol Bay. KVOC News recently had an opportunity to speak with Richard A. Charter, a marine conservation advocate with Environmental Defense, about the risks attendant with offshore drilling and about federal proposals to issue a new wave of offshore drilling licenses. So let's start off with sort of the generalities and sort of what has history taught us about offshore oil drilling and what are some of the effects that would concern people about it?
Well, generally, the issue of offshore drilling relates to what is called the outer continental shelf, that part of the continent that sticks out under the ocean. It's called the outer continental shelf, or the OCS. And drilling there has been going on in certain areas for quite some time. And up until 1969 in California, when we had a little accident in the Santa Barbara Channel down in Southern California, people tended to think of offshore drilling as something innocuous and benign and not very much could go wrong. But actually, in 1969, a drilling rig operated by Union Oil Company called Platform A suffered a blowout or an uncontrolled release of oil from the seafloor next to the platform. They were drilling. They encountered oil under great pressure, and it actually came around the drill hole itself and blew out a section of the seafloor next to the platform. And that event ultimately oiled about 125 miles of the California coast over a period of about 3 months. And the images that wound up on television, which were piles of dead birds 10 feet high and marine animals, seals and so forth, just dying on the beaches, along with the pathetic effort at cleaning it up, which was straw and steam cleaning of the rocks, really is credited as being one of the events that triggered the modern day environmental movement. This was kind of along with Rachel Carson's publication of Silent Spring, one of the events that created the whole conservation ethic in this country.
Now, I'm sure that offshore oil drilling advocates are going to say that there have been they've modernized the technology over the last 30 years. It's much safer today, and there's less risk. Now, there may be less risk, but is there still a risk for offshore oil drilling today?
Well, there are both the cataclysmic events like the Santa Barbara blowout, and there have been continuing events like that, the Ranger blowout off of Texas and the Ixtoc blowout in the Gulf of Mexico. So about every, seems like 10 years, we have one of these worst-case events. And what we learn from them is that actually the cleanup technology for responding to oil spills has not improved at all. On a real calm day, with no wind and no currents, you can clean up maximum about 20% of spilled oil if everything goes well. So you have not had the improvements in cleanup technology that would permit this type of activity to move into sensitive coastal areas where oil spills would have a severe impact on, you know, the marine environment. And in fact, now you have an administration that's trying to bring this technology into even more sensitive areas in Alaska, where there's no cleanup technology whatsoever for spills in broken sea ice conditions or spills under the sea ice. So we have a technology that actually is kind of outgrown the cleanup technology.
C- could you explain in detail some of the sort of environmental effects of one of these rather large cataclysmic disasters, and perhaps on the sort of other side of things, what are some of the negative environmental side effects of just things that are considered routine in offshore oil drilling? Because I'm sure there's things that you know, regulatory commissions just let pass because it's so routine that they don't want to damage the industry by over-regulating it.
Well, that's absolutely correct. And starting with the worst-case scenarios, the spills tend to be different from a tanker spill in that a tanker spill is a one-time release of oil. And whereas an offshore drilling spill caused by a blowout can go on for months and months, and frequently does, as they try to frantically figure out a way to stem the flow of oil. So you have, even when you can start to clean your beaches and remediate the shoreline, then you have another spill that comes in on the next tide. So these are ongoing events. And if you look at, for instance, the Exxon Valdez tanker spill in Alaska, where ultimately about 1,200 miles of the coast of Prince William Sound and out into Cook Inlet was oiled, and you know, all these years later, you can go back and dig among the rocky beaches of some of those beaches in Prince William Sound and find fresh oil just as if it were spilled yesterday. Now, you have events that certainly have an impact on the marine environment, cataclysmic impact, killing animals that can last for decades, and a slow poisoning of the ecosystem with the toxic fractions of the oil. Now, in terms of day-to-day routine impacts of offshore drilling, you have a discharge complex from each platform, each hole that's drilled, of toxic drilling muds and cuttings that can contain a range of heavy metals, benzene, hydrocarbon fractions, that sort of trail from the rig in whatever direction the current happens to be going. This is just a routine water pollution source out there. In some locations in the Gulf of Mexico, for example, the produced water, as it's called, the sort of subsea water table, the produced water from those drilling operations in the Gulf in some places is radioactive and contains radium. And so those rigs are trailing a radioactive plume that gets into the food chain and the fish and everything else. Each drilling operation is a major source of air quality degradation. The machinery that operates the drilling rig itself is polluting the air. And even when you're drilling only for natural gas, and of course it's just very specific areas where you have a more likelihood of finding natural gas rather than oil, there are explosion risks, there are toxic fractions associated with liquid natural gas condensate spill that are very toxic to fish. And so when everything goes right, you still have kind of an ongoing poisoning of the marine environment from these rigs.
I'd like to shift over to the sort of proposed licensing agreements between the state and corporations concerning new offshore oil platforms. What are some of the locations, and what are some of the risks in addition to the risks you've just described?
Well, the Bush administration is currently preparing what is called the 5-year offshore drilling program, which will cover federal waters on the U.S. coastline for the period of year 2002 to 2007. And that 5-year offshore drilling plan basically is the template for each what are called lease sales, or federal OCS lease sales. And those are basically the transfer of drilling rights from the federal government, who owns land in most states beyond 3 miles from shore as federal waters. And during a lease sale, those offshore tracts, which are 3 miles by 3 miles, or 9 square miles, are raffled off to the highest bidder among the oil companies for exploration and then development. Now, this has been a very contentious process for the last couple of decades, starting with former Interior Secretary James Watt. In 1982, Congress for the first time put what is called an offshore drilling moratorium on the Interior Appropriations Bill, the legislation that funds the Department of Interior. And what that moratorium does is it precludes the Interior Department from spending money for new lease sales in certain areas. Now, that moratorium has been renewed each year for 19 consecutive years and currently protects the entire U.S. West Coast, the entire U.S. Atlantic Coast, southern Florida, and parts of Alaska, particularly the Bristol Bay area, richest salmon fishery on the planet. And interestingly enough, just recently, the House of Representatives, by an overwhelming vote, determined that they were going to expand that moratorium to, for a six-month period, protect the coast of Florida a little further north than we've ever had a moratorium before, clear up into the Florida Panhandle near Pensacola, where Interior Secretary Gail Norton's been trying to hold a new lease sale that's been extremely controversial in Florida. And so now we're seeing Congress not only in the process of renewing that moratorium for its 20th year, but expanding it to protect the Gulf Coast of Florida.
Many offshore oil drilling advocates are going to say that, well, the environmental concerns are, you know, they're valid and they're a nice thing to keep in mind. But frankly, we need this oil. We need this natural gas. And so I ask you, is it even necessary to drill? I mean, is it going to, you know, hamper the economy that much to not, you know, drill in these locations that are highly sensitive to, you know, environmental disturbances?
Well, most of the local communities that are in the path of these federal drilling proposals have been strongly in opposition, primarily because their coastal economies are based on either commercial and sport fishing or coastal-dependent tourism, or basically a constellation of economic factors that relate to a healthy marine environment. And so coastal counties and cities historically have perceived federal offshore leasing as something that doesn't benefit them directly, perhaps very indirectly if there's an energy supply created, but in fact threatens their existing economy very immediately and very directly by pollution and interference with the attractiveness of their area, as well as onshore industrialization. The rigs offshore don't exist by themselves. There's almost always some kind of onshore industrial complex to service those rigs, as well as in places like Louisiana, the whole coastline has been eroded by pipeline corridors that were cut through the wetlands and then eroded away, and literally Louisiana is losing its coastline to damage caused by the oil industry. So in most places where this is now being proposed as a new activity, the level of opposition at the local level is very high. The question is, are we at a point in our society where we need to sacrifice some of our most important natural treasures in the quest for more oil and gas? And that is a question that so far in this administration has been dealt with in secret closed meetings as an energy plan was being formulated by the White House, but has not yet really been subjected to open political debate. And I think as it is, moving toward open political debate in the Congress, I think you're going to see that people aren't necessarily willing in this country to start sacrificing some of the places that they've considered sacrosanct over the years. I mean, there's a long tradition of conservation of special places, both on land in the national park system and along our coastline. And some of the places that are now being targeted for drilling, like the Outer Banks of North Carolina and the coast of Northern California, places like Mendocino, and places like 17 miles off the white crystal and sandy beaches of Pensacola, Florida, those are generating a lot of controversy because they're the Yellowstones and the Yosemites and the Grand Canyons of our coastline, and I don't think the public's ready to have them turned over to the oil companies. And I think the public would rather see some move toward responsible, painless energy efficiency and conservation first before we, as David Brower once called it, I believe, burn our cathedrals for firewood.
All right, so my final question sort of, you know, leads to, you know, all the evidence of the last, that you've stated of over the last 15 minutes sort of begs this following question. What can people do to influence these government proposals one way or the other? I mean, if they don't want to see this drilling, what can they do?
Well, as this activity now begins to focus also not just on the, you know, ocean coastline, but on the Great Lakes, where we're seeing Michigan's governor talking about lifting leasing restrictions on Lake Michigan and Lake Huron that have been in place since 97. We're seeing, first of all, a reaction in Congress. Representative Bart Stupak from Michigan has a bill, H.R. 1032, which would ban drilling in the Great Lakes. We're seeing, of course, Congress moving forward with renewing and expanding the moratorium that affects the marine environment around the, you know, east and west and Gulf Coast now of the U.S. And we, as an organization, believe that the public has a voice in this particular debate. And so we've set up a website which people can visit to actually take action. It has a letter that you can custom tailor and send to Interior Secretary Gail Norton commenting on these proposals. And that website is located at Action Network, one word, two N's in the middle, actionnetwork.org/campaign/OCS, as in Outer Continental Shelf. Again, that's Action Network, two N's in the middle, one word, .org/campaign/OCS. And that website will lead you to information as well as an opportunity to literally click and send the appropriate letter to the appropriate decision makers.
The previous interview was with Richard A. Charter, a marine conservation advocate with Environmental Defense. The background music in this feature is by the Antibalas Afrobeat Orchestra from Liberation Afrobeat Volume 1. The track is Nesta. That's it for this program. Reporting for KVSC News, I'm Jed Cousin.